climate change, disappearing species. Worried about the environment? Tune in to the new Green Voice of Vancouver, 1 o'clock, Fridays, for Radio EcoShock, only on CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio. Activism from BC and around the world, news, music, and interviews about our threatened planet. Find out what you can do about it. Radio EcoShock, Fridays, 1 o'clock on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio.
But what is not in doubt is that the scientific evidence of global warming caused by greenhouse gas emissions is now overwhelming. It is not in doubt that if the science is right, the consequences for our planet are literally disastrous. And this disaster is not set to happen in some science fiction future many years ahead, but in our lifetime. What is more, unless we act now, not sometime distant, but now, these consequences, disastrous as they are, will be irreversible. So there is nothing more serious, more urgent, more demanding of leadership, here, of course, but most importantly, in the global community. So this issue is the definition of global interdependence. We have to act together. This is an international challenge, and in the end, only an international solution will meet it and overcome it. Should we fail to rise to this challenge, I don't believe we will be able to explain ourselves to future generations.
Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme dedicated to climate change. The series takes its title from the emerging consensus that 2 degrees centigrade of average global temperature rise is a threshold that we absolutely must not cross if we are to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Later on in today's programme, we'll be speaking to Phil Thornhill. He's the founder and national coordinator of the Campaign Against Climate Change, who have been organising street demonstrations to highlight the urgent need for international action on climate change for the last 6 years. These demonstrations have grown exponentially in size, and on Saturday the 4th of November this year, international demonstrations will take place in some 50 countries around the world on the eve of the United Nations climate change talks in Nairobi.
Okay, and I mean, why do you think it's important for people to be out and counted on the street on that day?
Well, it's massively important because, I mean, it's sometimes put as a kind of personal responsibility problem, like picking up your own litter, do you know what I mean, reducing your carbon footprint. But realistically, when you take, you know, a cool, calm look at the science and the speed at which things are happening and what we actually need to do, it's clearly got to be something that's coordinated at government and indeed pan-government, i.e. international level. And the only way that that's going to happen is through political engagement, basically. And so for the politicians who are on our side, or more on our side than others, they are desperately looking for some kind of, street-level support, some sense of a public demand for action on climate change, for them to be able to actually act. And, you know, unless they do act, we don't really stand any chance of dealing with the problem. So it's absolutely crucial, and the way the political campaign builds up is going to be critical to whether we actually stand any chance of preventing essentially the catastrophic destabilization of the global climate.
There's been a lot of action just this week on climate change. First of all, in London, we have Tony Blair calling climate change the biggest threat humanity faces, following a report commissioned by his government. That was delivered by Sir Nicholas Stern, a former chief economist for the World Bank. It predicts an economic depression, if not chaos, unless carbon dioxide emissions are controlled starting now. We're talking with Ian Bruce, a climate campaigner for the David Suzuki Foundation. Ian, do you think this British report will have any impact here in Canada?
Most certainly. This report is the first extensive report on the economics behind global warming and the serious threat of climate change on our global economy. And this comes from definitely a voice that beforehand has not really been in the debates. And here we have one of the most accredited economists in the world, you know, clearly saying that climate change, the cost of inaction is far too great, and it will risk the future economy of the world if we don't take action.
Well, just this week, NDP leader Jack Layton demanded and got an emergency meeting with Prime Minister Stephen Harper, saying he would attempt to bring down the government unless Harper put some real action into the new climate legislation. And I can't think of a more urgent worry for Canadian voters. Do you think these political moves are going to bring Canada closer to climate reality?
Well, most certainly, I believe that Canadians have high expectations that the government needs to take action, and that are fed up with the simple rhetoric that has been delivered so far. We're seeing it throughout the country, for example, in Quebec, where the province of Quebec has put forward a very legitimate climate change action plan that includes significant policies that will help cut back on pollution there. And I think we're seeing more and more understanding in the media as well about this issue, and it's a top-of-mind concern for Canadians. And I think that the costs of climate change to Canada's economies as well is starting to mobilize people and to demand, and for the voters that are now demanding that the government put forward a legitimate and credible climate change plan.
Well, even people like the forest industry and the mining industry are worried about the lack of water and the disappearing pine trees with the pine bark beetle.
Exactly. Exactly. In BC alone, I think we'll be facing perhaps loss of the forestry industry because of climate change. So the question is, are we willing to jeopardize our water resources next and other industries such as fishing? These are all things that will have severe economic effects on our communities and on our economy here in British Columbia.
There's a Global Day of Action tomorrow night in downtown Vancouver, and that's part of a worldwide gathering in dozens of cities to shine light on the upcoming climate talks in Nairobi, Kenya. What are those talks?
Those talks are follow-up talks to the Kyoto Protocol. So that's the international efforts to reduce global warming by cutting back on heat-trapping emissions. So this is, there'll be over 180 nations represented at these meetings, and the focus of the meetings will talk about putting the first phase of Kyoto into action, which many countries are doing and Canada has yet to do, and also focusing on the next stage of Kyoto, which of the Kyoto Protocol, which will mean more and more countries joining in on the Kyoto Protocol with binding cuts in greenhouse gas pollution. So these are the meetings that are being held there, and there'll be a lot of pressure on Canada to strengthen its position on climate change, because simply we've completely abandon our commitments to date and have no climate change plan whatsoever on the table.
Is the Canadian government playing any pivotal role at the talks?
Unfortunately, at the last talks in Bonn, Germany, the Canadian government was playing a very obstructionist role in efforts to combat climate change, and we certainly hope that the Harper government will strengthen Canada's commitment and put the resources and regulations necessary to reduce Canada's emissions. Clearly, we've made international commitments regarding our role in combating climate change, and it's important that we step up to the plate and take on that responsibility, especially in light of the fact that we're trying to also get other countries such as China and India, countries whose emissions will grow in the future if action isn't taken. We're trying to build credibility in order to convince them that they need to take action as well.
Well, I think it's going to take some public pressure to wake up the Harper government. And there is this gathering tomorrow night on the steps of the Christchurch Cathedral at the corner of Georgia and Burrard in downtown Vancouver, starting at 6 p.m. It is organized by the Anglican Church, but it's not really a religious event. I didn't see anything about this in the Vancouver papers, and even some big environment groups don't seem to be promoting it much. Personally, we saw the communist empire in Eastern Europe fall when people took to the streets night after night. I'm wondering, what will it take to get people in British Columbia really active to save their climate?
Well, I think that things are starting to change and people are starting to mobilize. I mean, every day, weekly, we're seeing front page coverage of the potential effects of climate change if we don't take action. And these are coming from voices now outside the environmental circle as well. I mean, we are now have the leading economists in the world telling us that we need to take action. So I think that it's only a matter of time before British Columbians wake up to this fact, and I think that certainly it's important that we realize that a healthy environment is the economy. We rely on the environment to sustain all of the processes that we have going on in our communities. And these, I believe that it's important for Canadians to start putting environment on the election ballot when they go to vote. And it'll be important in the coming months that we put forward to all candidates running in any election that they have a strong platform that addresses global warming.
You know, the British author and columnist George Monbiot, he says we should all stop watching television and become climate campaigners, each and every one of us, until our children's future is safe. And I know David Suzuki's been very strong on climate change, and I see he's speaking coming up November 27th. Will the climate crisis be part of his speech, do you think?
Most certainly. This is the greatest environmental and economic threat facing the planet today. So it's a big focus of David's work and as well as the work of the foundation here. So it's something that we are actively working on and putting pressure on both the federal and provincial governments to take responsible action to reduce climate change.
How do people find out about David's upcoming appearance and the Suzuki Foundation?
You can go online to our website at www.davidsuzuki.org, and there's a full list of David's appearances as well as our press releases and recent reports and more on information on how people can get involved in making a difference.
Well, Ian Bruce, thanks for talking with Radio EcoShock, and will I see you downtown at the Global Day of Action tomorrow night?
You'll likely see me there, so I'll be out in force.
Good for you. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, your new voice for the environment, right here at CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio. Coming up, a new report says climate change threatens the world's economy. Then an interview with Canadian economist Dr. Michael Margolick. Off to Africa after that, following a sampling of great music and sad news. That continent is being attacked by carbon terrorists. Well, that would be us. We'll wrap up with a look at the American plan to control methane instead of carbon. Well, by the way, that's our plan too, now that Stephen Harper has joined the Methane to Markets Partnership and dumped Kyoto. Will it work, or will we fry? Stay tuned. First, you need to know about an important new report commissioned by the man who is slated to become the next Prime Minister of Britain, Gordon Brown. This latest warning about severe impacts from climate change comes not from Greenpeace or Friends of Earth, but from Sir Nicholas Stern. He was the chief economist for the World Bank. In a 700-page report that doesn't beat around the bush, it's really a stern warning. We could lose up to 20% of all the world's wealth to climate change, from things like weather disasters, persistent drought, rivers that dry up, disappearing species, and crops that fail. You may have heard about all this, but apparently Canada's new government has not. Although NDP leader Jack Layton journeyed to the Prime Minister's office just this week, warning he would bring down the government unless the new climate bill gets teeth. To stay in office, Mr. Harper has agreed to bring the bill back to the House of Commons Committee for more work, an unusual concession. Here are a few quotes from the Stern Report we all need to hear. Melting glaciers will initially increase flood risk and then strongly reduce water supplies, eventually threatening one-sixth of the world's population, predominantly in the Indian subcontinent, parts of China, and the Andes in South America. Declining crop yields, especially in Africa, could leave hundreds of millions without the ability to produce or purchase sufficient food. We'll bring you some of those voices from Africa, along with the music, in just a few minutes. The Stern Report continues, at 4 degrees and above, global food production is likely to be seriously affected. Climate change will increase worldwide deaths from malnutrition and heat stress. Vector-borne diseases like malaria and dengue fever could become more widespread. Rising sea levels will result in tens to hundreds of millions more people flooded each year with warming of 3 degrees or 4 degrees. There will be serious risks and increasing pressures for coastal protection in Southeast Asia, Bangladesh and Vietnam, small islands in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and large coastal cities such as Tokyo, New York, Cairo, and London. According to one estimate, by the middle of the century, 200 million people may become permanently displaced due to rising sea levels, heavier floods, and more intense droughts. The Stern Report continues, ecosystems will be particularly vulnerable to climate change, with around 15 to 40% of species potentially facing extinction after only 2 degrees of warming. And ocean acidification, a direct result of rising carbon dioxide levels, will have major effects on marine ecosystems, with possible adverse consequences on fish stocks. Heat waves like that experienced in 2003 in Europe, when 35,000 people died and agricultural losses totaled $15 billion, will be commonplace by the middle of the century. Well, those are some of the quotes. But as an economist, Sir Nicholas Stern advises the UK government that all this does not need to happen. Instead of losing 20% of the whole world production to climate chaos, we could spend about 1% to begin the transition to a carbon-reduced economy right now. Every year that passes makes the task more difficult and much more expensive, and at some point we may not be able to save ourselves and other life forms at all. Here's what Stern recommends, quote, stabilizing at or below 550 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent would require global emissions to peak in the next 10 to 20 years and then fall at a rate of at least 1 to 3% a year. By 2050, global emissions would need to be around 25% below current levels. These cuts will have to be made in the context of a world economy in 2050 that may be 3 to 4 times larger than today. So emissions per unit of GDP would need to be just 1/4 of current levels by 2050. In the past, Stern explains, the cost of dumping carbon has been an externality, something pushed outside the cost of doing business. That has to end. Carbon needs a definite price supported by governments around the world. Then competition and price saving in the marketplace will drive down carbon emissions. Quote, putting an appropriate price on carbon, explicitly through tax or trading or implicitly through regulation, means that people are faced with the full social costs of their actions. This will lead individuals and businesses to switch away from high carbon goods and services and to invest in low carbon alternatives. Stern also calls for major investment in research to lower the cost of alternative fossil-free energy and to increase the efficiency of all energy use. And we must control deforestation. The report says, quote, emissions from deforestation are very significant. They're estimated to represent more than 18% of global emissions, a share greater than is produced by the global transport sector. That ends our quote. That needs to be backed up by government policies, he says, that shape individual and corporate behavior towards a low-carbon lifestyle. Stern even thinks the government should play an active role using advertising and other media to warn people about the extreme costs of climate change. Here's a clip from a climate ad already running in the United Kingdom. Again, this isn't sponsored by Greenpeace, but by the government itself.
Life depends on the warmth of the sun being trapped by a layer of gases that surround the Earth. We now produce so much of these heat-trapping gases that the layer is getting thicker, heating the world, changing our climate and threatening our way of life. As the world gets hotter, the climate will change and some of the extreme effects we have witnessed will become more frequent, making our planet a more hostile place to live. If we could see the gases, the causes of the problem would be obvious to everyone. And if you could see the effect we are having on our planet, you'd do something about it. The solutions exist, and it's not too late to make a difference, but we have to act now, today. Government, industry, and individuals acting together to tackle the problem. For more information and to get involved, visit climatechallenge.gov.uk. Tomorrow's climate is today's challenge.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
The latest report on climate impacts for the British government says it will cost far more to keep up our carbon pollution than it would to fix it. This comes not from an environmentalist, but from Sir Nicholas Stern, former chief economist for the World Bank. To explore the economic argument for protecting our climate, we have a Canadian economist who has been an independent consultant in energy and climate change. Michael Margalek has also worked for the Greater Vancouver Regional District. Dr. Margalek, here is one line from the Stern report. It says, "Climate change presents a unique challenge for economics. It is the greatest and widest-ranging market failure ever seen. Does this mean we need more government intervention or a new model for economics?"
I would have to say more of the latter than the former. And I think it's important to understand the... It's a little bit like when you have all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I mean, the scope of the problem is so long-term, the impact's unknown, and in particular the so-called damage costs, the economic losses resulting from climate change itself, are extremely difficult to estimate. So, you know, the economic framework in which you are really seeking a benefit-to-cost ratio is somewhat inadequate as a mental framework for dealing with the problem.
So the economics being taught in universities today, they don't, as far as I can understand, take into account the real costs of carbon pollution. Is that right?
Well, it's really the question is, what do you mean by the real costs? I mean, under an economic interpretation, there's all kinds of rules and methods of evaluation techniques, and they've advanced considerably, and there's a rich, you know, a rich intellectual tradition that's been built up on how to deal with these things. But I think that especially the best economists in particular are the ones that caveat the reports very heavily, as does the Stern report, by saying, you know, this problem is so large, long-term, complex, global in nature that the tools of economics are of limited utility in understanding it.
Well, the worst problems in the report are predicted for people living closer to the equator, for the poorest countries like Bangladesh. Do you think the North American economy can just go ahead and prosper while hundreds of millions of people may suffer from our carbon pollution?
Well, no, and obviously this is a huge global equity issue and was... you know, really treated that way in the UN negotiations that led to the Framework Convention and the Kyoto Protocol. There's no doubt in my mind that the developed economies will have much more ability, just by virtue of their wealth and their ability to reallocate resources and have the resources, they will not suffer to nearly the same extent as the less developed economies. And so, yeah, it represents big shifts in global welfare.
In global welfare, there have even been suggestions that we're going to have to be taxed, perhaps to reimburse or pay for the damage that's being done to other countries. Do you think that will become a reality?
I'm in the current you know, the way the world works now, I can't imagine an international tax or related to, you know, excess consumption by the North, for example. You know, the Kyoto Protocol did involve a trading framework in which developing countries could be rewarded for emission reduction projects that they do in their countries, but that's really a very small corner of the kind of economic shifts that we're talking about. So, yeah, I can't see the nations of the world getting together and agreeing to a tax on consumption in wealthy countries like that.
Well, getting back to Canada, how can business adopt to a leaner carbon model?
The most effective instrument for business is to price CO2 emissions. That is the way that the business world works. It's a very efficient way of allocating the costs of emission reduction. And so I've always been an advocate of a cap and trade system for Canadian industry.
And I know that some of the early adopters have lost out. They didn't have the support of government or even consumer awareness. Do you think it's finally time to make some money from alternative energy?
Well, I think people are making money from alternative energy. Wind power is the fastest growing energy source in the world and one of the fastest growing industries, period. So I think, you know, it's largely economic factors, things like the price of natural gas going up, that have caused growth in alternative energy. But I think that shift is happening.
Were you an advisor for a company that was trying to put up wind power here in BC?
I am an officer of an employee of a wind power development company, yes.
And how is that coming? Because as far as I know, we don't have a big wind farm off the coast of BC yet.
No, but we're trying to build one.
And what are the hurdles towards building it? Is it getting the investment or the government permits, or what do you think is...
There are many hurdles to investment in this project, as there are to any power project in BC. Any project, including ours, will have to obtain environmental permission. It will have to consult with and obtain some form of agreement with First Nations in whose traditional territory the project lies. It will have to, most importantly, obtain a power purchase agreement with a buyer, and of course the big buyer in the province is BC Hydro. It will have to obtain various permits, in the case of small hydro, municipal permits, and so on. So, there are many barriers to development of any power project in this province.
Well, you mentioned municipal permits, but it sounds like the province is bypassing that and saying, well, we'll issue all the permits.
Yes, that is Bill 30, and that has occurred, yeah.
The provincial government seems stuck in the old mold to me. They're building more highways for cars and trucks. What do you think the Greater Vancouver Regional District should be doing?
Well, the GVRD does have its livable region strategic plan, and I understand that certain elements of the Gateway program have been deemed to be inconsistent with that plan. I don't know how much statutory or legal power the GVRD has to change these things, but I think a political position in support of the existing LRSP and the principles in it makes a lot of sense for the region.
What's the LRSP? I'm sorry.
Livable Region Strategic Plan.
Good. All right. And how has your own work touched on energy and climate change?
I've worked in the sector for almost 30 years. I was an employee of BC Hydro and Resource Planning. I was the executive director of the BC Energy Council. I consulted for about 12 years for clients in industry, government, and for NGOs as well. I've done many, many different things over the course of my career in energy and climate change.
So from that viewpoint, do you think that the Stern Report is some sort of turning point as far as both government and business will be concerned?
Well, I think it'll have a significant effect in the UK, but the UK is already, what the report does is as indicate or support the direction that the UK government is taking. I don't really know. I mean, there have been many other integrated assessments that have come up with conclusions in the similar direction, although I have to say the Stern report is very comprehensive and definite in its conclusions. But, yeah, I mean, it's another report that supports taking action, and I think it's a good thing.
We've been speaking with economist Michael Margalek. Thanks for talking with Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Take a trip,
it's all about repatriation.
If we take a trip up to Africa, I know you will feel no pain. Got to take a trip now.
My brothers and sisters,
got to take a trip.
Oh yeah,
take a trip
out of Babylon.
When we talk climate change, the things that we're seeing that are already changing in terms of weather patterns, we don't have rains when we expected rain, temperatures are higher, and all this is happening because of global warming. The whole atmosphere of the earth is warming up.
It may be a global phenomenon, but its effect is most urgently felt here in the world's poorest continent. Africa is already 0.5 degrees Celsius warmer than it was a century ago, the report says, and the mercury is still rising. The report's authors say the continent is undergoing extreme environmental changes. Drought-prone areas are getting drier, and drought is afflicting more of the continent than ever. Paradoxically, wet areas are simultaneously getting wetter, with torrential downpours destroying crops and arable land.
Africa is both uniquely vulnerable to climate change, it's experiencing above average temperature rises, and is likely to see more of those over the coming century, and the parts of the land vulnerable to extreme drought will get more.
There is also a phenomenon known as flipping. Every 10 years or so, in an arc from central to northeast Africa, wet areas suddenly become dry, while dry areas become wet. The report calls for two major changes of policy by countries in the developed world. The first is to reduce carbon emissions, ultimately by up to 90%. The UK's production of greenhouse gases, the report says, is still rising. Second, it wants a much bigger provision of financial assistance to the affected areas of Africa to help under-resourced governments take the kind of action that will help their populations cope. This, the report estimates, will cost the developed world between $10 and $40 billion a year. Growing climate chaos, the report says, argues for action on a global scale, but in particular by the rich industrialized world. For Africa's misfortune is that it is the continent which contributes least to global warming, but suffers first and most acutely. Alan Little, BBC News.
Farming is my life, is my culture. It has a very big impression of, it impresses a big history in my life. It brings the family together. So if one separates me from farming, is like a person has already killed me and buried me in the ground. I'm a proud farmer and I've liked it, and I want to remain a farmer. I want to go on farming till I go to rest into the grave.
And how does global warming affect you as a farmer?
This one has affected me, as I've already said. In the absence of water, you can't farm. So the yields have gone down. My financial status has also been tempered with. So At one time, my granddaughter was asking me to say, Grand, when are we going to have the green maize? I said, we'll only have it when we have rain water. But where is it? I said, I don't know. It is somewhere stuck in heaven.
Global warming is set to make many of the problems which Africa already deals with much, much worse. In the last year alone, 25 million people in sub-Saharan Africa have faced the food crisis. Global warming means that many dry areas are going to get drier and wet areas are going to get wetter. They're going to be caught between the devil of drought and the deep blue sea of floods.
Now, of course, while you say the problem's going to affect them greatly, they're not particularly bad when it comes to producing greenhouse gases, are they?
The great tragedy is that Africa as a continent has played virtually no role whatsoever in creating the problem of global warming. That's been the result of the economic activity in the rich industrialized countries. So now we've got kind of two choices. The rich countries are under a huge obligation to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. But even in the UK, which is claiming global leadership on this problem, our emissions are rising. The other thing that we could do is help with meaningful financial assistance so that Africa can help adapt to the global warming, which is going to happen anyway. But at the last count, the two special pots of money that were set up to help the continent had only one-tenth of the amount of money originally pledged in them.
The problems faced by Africa have been put on the map, haven't they, in recent years? But what you're saying is initiatives like cancelling debt really are not what they need. What they need is, firstly, for us to cut our emissions of greenhouse gases and also for us to help them deal with the effects of global warming.
One of the great potential tragedies is that over the last 10 or 15 years, a huge amount of effort has gone into getting a better trade deal for Africa, to writing off many of its debts, to dealing with problems of disease. But with global warming blindsided, all those best efforts could come to nothing. You've got some very poor, vulnerable countries like Niger, which has been incredibly hardly hit by drought, and aid to Niger has plummeted. You've got things so bad in some areas, like in northwest Kenya, that the local people give the droughts names. The one they've just been going through has been dubbed the one that divided homes, because it forced so many people to go and seek their livelihoods elsewhere. And they've been in almost continuous drought since 1999, when they had a drought which was called "It Has Swept Away Everything, Even Animals." So unless we tackle the problem of climate change and get the resources in place and the climate-proof, climate-friendly policies in place to help the continent develop, then you're not going to see the end of poverty. You're going to see things getting much worse.
Some of those consequences are seen in Darfur. You write about how the crisis in Darfur is connected directly to climate change. What do you mean by that?
Tim Flannery, author of The Weathermakers.
Well, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Australia, the crisis had already started then in the 70s, and it was inevitably portrayed as a crisis that was brought about by land mismanagement, that these ignorant and primitive people, was sort of the general impression you got, you know, had overgrazed their land and caused a changing climate that was now having a negative impact on them. Mm. In fact, that is not true at any level. What we see now with the recent science that's been done very rigorously to try to understand what's caused the decrease in rainfall is that it's occurring because of increased sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean. That accounts for about half of the rainfall decrease. The other half is caused by particulate pollution over Europe. So, you know, it's that comforting message that this was somehow a problem caused by these people, brought on them by themselves, by their own actions, is simply not true. It's been misrepresented.
we have seen the impact of climate change, especially to start with, it is the government had all the plans disrupted, because the government would plan for government development programs, and then these will have to stop, because the government will have instead to feed the people and use the money that was set aside for educational programs, for health programs, water, instead it will be used for feeding people. But also at the grassroots level, where the people are, it is felt even more, because there you find that people go without water, because most of their water is dried up. There has been no rain for maybe several years. And then not just water, but food shortage. People have to go and search for food. Actually, sometimes people just go in the wild and try to find fruit in the bush to eat, because they cannot find food anywhere. Not just that, but you find that there is also migration, that people move from one place to another, not because of war, but because of starvation, in search of food. And sometimes not all families move. Sometimes children are left at home, and these children go to school, so they stop going to school. So there is school attendance dropout because kids cannot go to school and they are starving. Diseases as well, because there is dirty water and people cannot boil their water. They just use it as it is. This brings more diseases as well, and trachoma and things like that. Deaths also under fives because of malnutrition, that also happens. People rely on agriculture and they want to get food from the farming. If they don't get food from farming and there's no rain in the area and they can't grow things in the area, they have to move, they have to migrate and find places where they can find food or places where they can grow food.
Who is to be blamed for this major problem?
The Western countries, for example, they are the most industrialized countries. They are the ones, I think, to blame. Because with all the carbon dioxide, you know, the emissions, they're not cutting out. So this all brings, I think, effect on the climate. Without dealing with the causes of climate change won't help poverty, because poverty may be being bred from climate change as well. So they must deal with that as well if they are to fight poverty.
So if one separates me from farming, is like a person has already killed me and buried me in the ground.
In this Africa update from www.ecoshock.org, you have heard from the BBC, CBC, and Voices from Africa on radioafrica.oneworld.net. Music slices from Toots and the Maytals tribute album, The Moses Choir on the Rough Guide to South African Gospel, Mathalini and the Motahela Queens, Baba Mal's I Will Follow You, and finishing out with Lucky Dubé's House of Exile.
Of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times.
The Methane Fix, a report from Radio EcoShock. This is the third in a series of broadcasts about the American-led alternative to controlling carbon dioxide emissions in the desperate fight to control global climate change. The first part was an interview with Dr. Phil Austin, an atmospheric scientist. That was followed by a primer on methane, what it is, where it comes from, and how it damages both our health and the climate. These can be downloaded from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Now we look at the American program as proposed by top NASA scientists and as adopted by several industrialized countries, including the United Kingdom, Australia, and lately Canada. Can it work? Or will we fry? A group of scientists from Harvard University, the Argonne National Laboratory, and the EPA say that both air pollution and global warming could be mitigated by controlling methane gas. You will hear this proposal coming from various governments. They say, will fight smog for your personal health and stave off global warming all at the same time. Let's investigate. In addition to its own global warming potential, methane is directly related to the production of ozone in the lower atmosphere, called the troposphere. And ozone is also a greenhouse gas, as well as a killing agent in smog. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, predicts more and more intense ozone pollution and smog by the year 2030, despite pollution control efforts. So smog is going to get worse for city dwellers around the world. While the smog-inducing nitrous oxides from pollution may decline up to 10% in developed countries, it is expected to increase by 130% in developing countries. The A1 scenario from the IPCC predicts methane emissions could increase by 43% globally by 2030. That is why there could be worse global smog despite localized benefits from pollution controls in industrialized countries. In one example of this trend of linking smog and global warming, Arlene M. Fiore wrote an article in Geophysical Research Letters in October 2002. She said, where there is plenty of methane in the presence of nitrous oxide and sunlight, smog is the inevitable result, and much of that is so-called ground-level ozone, a greenhouse gas. If we could limit methane while cleaning up nitrous oxide, we could curb smog and global warming at the same time, the argument goes. An even stronger case for going after trace gases like methane, ozone, and nitrous oxide was made by Dr. James Hansen, the climate expert from NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Dr. Hansen has a long career in the field and is well regarded by environmentalists. He was the subject of recent news articles claiming to be muzzled by the Bush White House. According to an article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Hansen and Mikato Sato claimed that the climate could be stabilized with warming less than 1 degree just by reducing methane and other trace gases, even if carbon dioxide zooms up to 520 parts per million. The authors suggest adding these trace gases to the Montreal Protocol as a method of control. Here is what Hansen said about it. Carbon dioxide is the main greenhouse gas, and slowdown of its emissions must have priority. It will be a growing issue in international relations for decades, if not longer. However, that does not necessarily mean that Kyoto is the best way to address the trace gases. Kyoto gives too little or no weight to gases such as methane, the trace gas HFC-134a, ozone, and the precursor gases that form ozone. We could get moving now on non-carbon dioxide gases with benefits such as improved human health, in addition to a slowing of global warming. The resulting international goodwill might also make discussions about carbon dioxide more productive. These scientists add that controlling human-made trace gases could more rapidly control warming, and so reduce the positive feedback loops that could release natural methane from such sources as frozen methane, called clathrates, on the ocean floor, or from the Siberian permafrost melting. This approach was also promoted by scientists at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Jos Liebefeld, an atmospheric chemist there, says, "It will be very difficult to control carbon dioxide in the short-term future. Not only because of energy consumption and political consequences, but also because the lifetime of carbon dioxide is enormously long. And so, if climate change is really affecting our daily lives in a really undesirable way, like stronger hurricanes or more droughts in some areas, then there may be the desire to do something on the short term. One of the few alternatives that we have there is to reduce methane." End quote. The American approach, under the pro-oil Bush administration, is to combine efforts to fight smog with the battle to control global warming. As there is no effort from the world's biggest carbon dioxide polluter to limit CO2, the methane and trace gas approach is not just Plan A or Plan B, it's their only plan. That is why we have to understand methane, ozone, and other trace gases to find out whether this is just more fantasy or a real plan that could work.
I will not accept a plan that will harm our economy and hurt American workers.
Another NASA scientist,
Drew Schindel, is calling for a whole new way of studying greenhouse gases. The IPCC scientists have generally totaled the amount of all greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to create models of expected climate change. Schindel says we have to look closer at the Earth's surface to see where these gases are coming from and how they interact chemically before they end up as totals in the upper atmosphere. For example, just knowing the raw data on the amount of methane produced doesn't give a good picture. Methane reacts with other chemicals, such as nitrous oxide and carbon monoxide from automobile and industrial exhausts, to change atmospheric chemistry, including producing more ground-level ozone. Schindel's study suggests that methane may have double the impact on global warming compared to previous calculations. The IPCC, just looking at the total amount of methane accumulated, attributed about one-sixth of global warming was due to methane. But when all the chemical reactions related to methane are added, including the tropospheric ozone, methane may be responsible for as much as one-third of the climate change we are seeing, Schindel suggests. He writes, "If we control methane, which the U.S. is already starting to do, then we are likely to mitigate global warming more than one would have thought, so that's a very positive outcome. Control of methane emissions turns out to be a more powerful lever to control global warming than would be anticipated." End quote. And we have another paper forwarded by James Hansen in January 2006 by Arlene Fiore and other scientists titled "Global Health Benefits of Mitigating Ozone Pollution with Methane Emission Controls." The authors argue that controlling methane will greatly reduce human deaths from pollution because it reduces surface ozone as well. The savings in greenhouse gases are a bonus to cutting smog, they argue. According to this study, reducing human-made methane emissions by just 20% beginning in 2010 could prevent 30,000 deaths around the world in 2030. Still, the main emphasis is reducing human deaths from air pollution by controlling methane rather than saving planetary life by controlling carbon dioxide, the gas considered by most to be the main actor in runaway climate change. Meanwhile, other studies indicate that all countries are emitting far more methane than they declare. Bergamaschi, for example, suggests the UK released 4.2 million tons of methane in 2004 instead of the 2.1 million tons declared by the government. During his study, the German government raised its estimates of methane emissions by 70%. And that's in Europe. The largest sources, China, Russia, and India, don't really know how much methane they are releasing, and have very little in place to stop the hemorrhaging of this powerful greenhouse gas.
What now, Blake?
We should flee in terror. Yes, that would be the wisest course.
But when we measure total methane in the atmosphere, the recent annual increases are being kept in check, in just the last few years, by some natural agent. We don't know what that protective mechanism may be, or how temporary it is. We could see a methane surge with temperatures going up 1 to 3 degrees globally in just a few years. That is possible. What can you do? The single largest source of methane in the developed countries is landfills leaking methane from the mountains of pointless consumer waste. If you demand less packaging, recycle more, and waste less, methane could be substantially reduced. Your second personal option is also quite straightforward. Become a vegan, a vegetarian with no animal products or byproducts. That's the solution offered by a group called EarthSave. At www.earthsave.org/globalwarming, you can find the controversial article titled "A New Global Warming Strategy: How Environmentalists Are Overlooking Vegetarianism as the Most Effective Tool Against Climate Change in Our Lifetimes." Animal husbandry may be the single largest human-made source of methane on the planet when you add emissions from the animals plus the gases coming from treatment of manure. We have a massive increase of meat eating, allegedly 5 times more meat in North America, for instance, than in 1950. This is matched by a massive increase in the number of cows, pigs, and sheep. There are over 1 billion cows eating their way through feed grown with fossil fuels. In fact, modern agriculture uses natural gas, that is, methane, to produce fertilizer. That gas leaks at production sites, at refineries, in pipelines, and in final use. An article in The New Scientist in December 2005 said that when all these fossil fuel inputs to factory farm meat are considered, plus the methane produced by animals themselves, you do more for the planet by changing to a vegan diet than buying a hybrid car. A meat eater produces the equivalent of almost 1.5 tons more carbon dioxide annually than a vegan does. The exact figures for animal use and a proposal to trim back methane through changes of diet have not been seriously considered. Obviously, we'd rather burn in hell than give up the burgers for a healthier diet and a safer atmosphere. What are governments doing? Since the United States has no coherent plan to reduce carbon dioxide, it has invested a relatively small portion of its budget in a single plan, as proposed by its NASA scientists, to reduce methane and other trace greenhouse gases. The Bush administration has actually reduced American methane emissions to 5% below 1990 levels, a kind of Kyoto for trace gases. This effort is led by the Environmental Protection Agency and spans many different government departments. It's called the Methane to Markets Partnership. For example, the government has helped coal mines in America capture methane to run power operations, and they've aided local governments who want to install methane capture devices to landfills. This government likes methane programs because they capture energy that has a resale and reuse value, whereas carbon capture is more or less a straight expense with little payback, if any. The Methane to Markets Partnership has been promoted as an international effort. So far, Australia, India, Italy, Japan, Mexico, the Ukraine, the United Kingdom, and most recently Canada have become partners in the program. Each country tries to reduce its methane by recovering it. Notice that the largest methane producers, Russia, China, India, and Brazil, are not partners in this American effort. However, the Americans have invested a few million dollars in pilot projects in Asia. In 2006, the World Bank's Global Environmental Facility is spending $7 million, over 5 years, to support a comprehensive approach to reduce the impact of concentrated livestock production there. Hardly a major investment in one of the top methane-producing countries. It's difficult to see how a global supply of this powerful greenhouse gas can be reined in without a much larger commitment by all countries and a huge budget to implement it. In addition, the sources of methane are very diverse. Can we really rework the way all Chinese and other Asian rice paddies are planted? Does the government of India have the control and resources to deliver top-quality feed to all its cattle? Plus manure processing with methane capture facilities? Can we re-educate every peasant farmer? What happens if the current methane capping mechanism, whatever that turns out to be, breaks down? What happens if natural sources of methane are released in large quantities as a feedback and byproduct of global warming caused by uncontrolled carbon dioxide levels? As a plan to save the planet, the methane fix has holes larger than the growing ozone hole in the stratosphere. We may please city dwellers by cutting down smog and feel like we're really doing something. We may have interesting looking pipes and plants to recapture methane in a few places. We may even reduce worldwide emissions of methane from human sources, and we must. But the methane scheme is just a secondary alternative to facing the carbon beast head on. Sadly, it looks like a political fix for an oil-based White House and their supporting cast of other oil burners around the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.